very proud.
Thank you for inviting me here. I'm going to talk about our work with Brock Twiddy about Centrino NLSP, signatures of Centrino NLSP at the LHC. We'll talk mostly about this work, and if I have a little bit more time, I will talk about the work in progress, which is about to exist. So, the outline of the talk. First, I would like to talk about the motivation, what actually motivates us to think about this possibility, and what is actually the main goal of the project. What are the generic features of the spectrum where Centrino is an NLSP, and it's actually possible to draw quite generic conclusions about those spectra and to divide those spectra into several types, into actually two types, only by their collider signatures. Then I will talk to the cascades and signatures in what I call ideal world, namely without the backgrounds, with perfect resolution. I'll talk about counting of the leptonic events. I will show that even this counting becomes quite suggestive. I will talk a little bit more about the structure in the leptonic and trileptonic channel. Those are two things. Also quite suggestive. If I have time, a little bit more about the additional tool, which is jet lepton invariant mass. And then I will go to the real signatures and the main bodies, which are the backgrounds here, and check which are of these tools are realistic and can they possibly use. It actually turns out that lots of these tools, up to some extent, can be used quite efficiently. Then, if I have time, I'll talk precisely about the work in progress for the active right-handed celtrons and the spectrum. And at the end, I will conclude. So, the first question is, Centrino NLSP at the bottom of the spectrum. The first question is, can Centrino actually be at the bottom of the spectrum? Can it be, for example, the lighter supersymmetric particle or the dark matter candidate? And we know that once we're talking about left-handed Centrino, the answer is, of course, no, mainly due to direct detection experiment. If it was at the bottom of the spectrum, it had been at the bottom of the spectrum and stable, it was actually very easy to detect it in dark matter direct detection due to Z mediation between the nuclei, right down core, but actually between the nuclei and the neutrino. This cross-section is quite big, and we know from the bounds we get now, we have now mainly from CDMS, that this possibility is excluded for very wide range of masses of neutrinos. So this neutrino should be really, really heavy, and as such heavy that it's probably beyond the excess of the current colliders.
So that's with a thermal scenario?
Sorry?
Is that a thermal scenario conditional statement, or?
It's the statement where I assume that it is a dark matter. It has a correct relic abundance, the measured relic abundance.
Yes.
And it's left-handed, that's it. So the cross-section is too big, and this neutrino should be really, really heavy. But there is, of course, a giveaway out of this situation. There are actually two giveaways. There is this possibility, I'm going to talk a little bit less about it, where we will give up on R parity, and Centrino is going to be at the bottom of the spectrum, but all the supersymmetric particles are actually unstable and eventually decay into the standard model particles. This happens if we give up on R parity. I'm not going to talk too much about R parity, but if the R parity violation is small and the decay of the lighter supersymmetric particles occurs beyond the detector, our analysis will also capture this possibility. The second possibility I would like to concentrate on is that it is at the bottom of the spectrum, but we have one more particle which is very weakly interacting, gravitino, which is the true lighter supersymmetric particles. And in this case, Centrino will be able to undergo invisible decays. It will decay into neutrino and gravitino. Of course, both products of this decay are invisible. So, sorry?
Don't worry about it.
Let's continue with this. With the study, so we should probably ask if there's any top-down motivation for this scenario. And it turns out that there is. So Citrino at the bottom of the spectrum is not easy to get in very minimal models, but nonetheless, it happens. For example, if we are talking about gauge mediation, where having gravitino as the lightest supersymmetric particle is extremely natural. Gravitino is naturally the lightest supersymmetric particle in gauge mediation. We actually quite readily find neutrino and LSP in the big portion of general gauge mediation parameter space. It actually turns out that there is a very marginal part of parameter space, even of ordinary gauge mediation, because neutrino is the next to the lightest supersymmetric particle. But it's very hard to get to this part of the parameter space. Once we do not restrict ourselves to the minimal models and just scan over general gauge mediation parameter space, we find neutrino occupying quite a big portion of this parameter space. And a bit later, I will show actually why does it happen. It's not the only possibility. Neutrino can be also LSP even in high-scale mediated SUSY breaking. For example, it was pointed out that there's a possibility in high-scale Gugino mediation with a non-universal boundary condition for the Higgs masses, namely if the soft mass of the down-type Higgs is much, much bigger than the soft mass of the up-type Higgs, and it's high-scale gauge mediation, then the running effects will push neutrino downwards and it will eventually be at the bottom of the supersymmetric spectrum. It's not natural in these cases that gravitino is the lightest supersymmetric particle. It's expected to be of order of magnitude of the rest of the particles, so this shouldn't be taken for granted. Nonetheless, it is a possibility that accidentally the lightest supersymmetric particle is actually a gravitino. So this is also a possibility. So here we go to the motivation of this project and the main question I would like to address. If neutrino is next to the lightest supersymmetric particle, the last step of the cascade is completely invisible, and this invisibility has nothing to do with the lifetime of gravitino, since the products of this decay are completely invisible, neutrino and gravitino. From the point of view of collider behavior, this looks too similar to the neutralino LSP or maybe long-lived NLSP. So we would like to ask, is it possible practically to distinguish between two of these possibilities, namely neutralino LSP or long-lived NLSP at the bottom of the spectrum versus neutrino LSP? And in order to answer this question, let first to address the generic features of this spectrum and to show actually that if neutrino is an LSP, it has actually quite generic features. It can never come by itself. So if it is neutrino, neutrino is a part of the left-handed doublet. In the limit where electronic symmetry is not broken, the masses are exact of the left-handed slepton and neutrino are exactly degenerate. So just because it's the same doublet and they are protected by electronic symmetry. They will be splitted nonetheless when electronic symmetry is broken, and we should ask what is this splitting. So the leading contribution to the splitting comes from the D terms of SU2, where we have interaction Higgs-Higgs, left-handed lepton, left-handed lepton, and then DA-DA, we have interacting four term. This splits the masses. And the splitting after we first neglect right-left mixing between the scalars, we find that this mixing has this value. What can we learn from this value? First of all, since cosine of twice beta is negative, this value is always positive, namely neglecting left-right mixing. If the left-handed slepton doublet is placed at the bottom of the spectrum, it's a destiny to get neutrino, the lightest particle, if we don't talk about gravitino, because it is lighter than the left-handed slepton. It's suppressed by twice the mass of this doublet, and it's also proportional to the cosine, which is smaller than 1. namely, this value, this mass difference, is always smaller than the mass of the doublet. This is the mass of the doublet. We actually expect, of course, that this doublet is, the mass of the doublet is smaller than the mass of the W, so MW over twice mass of the electron is suppression rather than enhancement. So what are numerical values we can expect if we, for example, substitute here tangent beta equals 10 and mass of this electron 150 GeV, which we can expect to be, which we can expect from the particle which is at the bottom of the spectrum, this splitting becomes 21 GeV. It's actually natural to expect here the splitting of order of magnitude of around 20 GeV, maybe a little bit smaller, maybe a little bit bigger, but this is more or less the ballpark of the split. So assume we produced somehow this left-handed slepton in the collector. How will it decay? It has only its neutrino underneath it, the only particle. Now I will not ask about the possibility how we produce it. It will, at the end of the day, be cascade decay from the particles, which we produce quite a lot, colored superparticles. But I'm not asking this question now. Assume we produce it. How will it decay? So the main decay chain is actually emitting W. And since the mass splitting is around 20 GeV, and it's, we know it's always smaller than W, this W must be off-shell. Actually, in most of the cases, it's highly off-shell because the splitting here is just 20 GeV, it's much smaller than the mass of the W. W off-shell can either emit quarks, namely jets, soft jets, which are probably quite invisible in the collider, and the signature, which might be interesting, where it goes to neutrino and electron. So several remarks about this left-handed slepton decay. First of all, most part of the time, something like two-thirds of all the cases, it decays into jets, which is probably useless. Nonetheless, 20% of the time, it emits leptons. Emits leptons, so maybe it will be a signature we're going to chase for. Flavor correlation of this lepton with the mother particle is completely lost. Let's take a look on this diagram. We start from this left-handed lepton, which has some flavor, but since the mediation is through W, flavor flows to this neutrino, and this lepton is uncorrelated with its parent particle. Decay products may be often quite soft because the splitting is just several dozens GeV. It doesn't necessarily mean that they are invisible, because if we produce these leptons in decay chains, they might be boosted. But nonetheless, in most of the cases, they are quite soft. Soft jets are definitely useless and invisible, but nonetheless, relatively soft, but maybe visible leptons can be useful, but not in direct productions. Since so, if we,
is this still a prompt decay?
Sorry?
Is it still a prompt decay?
Absolutely. You never see, the lifetime is so tiny that you never see secondary products.
So you're ignoring how it's being produced.
Now I talk about generic features. So talking about, this is definitely correct, talking about the generic features, how slepton decays. Yes. Given that it is produced.
Okay, but the different decays, whether they're useful or not, will depend upon what else, how it's being produced, of course. So you're going to get into more details on.
Of course, I'm going to get more details on this. Yes, so immediately I say you already one result that in direct production it's not going to be useful because you don't have even anything to trigger on the effect. So before we go further, let's ask the question, when is our analysis going to be valid? There can be several worries about what I talk. First, what happens if the slepton's neutrino splitting is affected by left-right mixing? And of course, I mean left-right mixing for sleptons because I don't have right-handed neutrino in this analysis. Right-handed neutrino is a different particle, completely different curvature with different signatures, and I'm not going to take talk anything about this. We assume here that the whole CISO mechanism occurs at the very high scale and it's unaffected by the right-handed neutrinos. Nonetheless, we have left-right mixing, which corrects this split. So if we assume small atoms, which is absolutely natural in gauge mediation, and in lots of cases happens, even in high-scale mediation, it's absolutely natural, for example, in D-genome mediation, that the atoms are very small, or even zero at the mediation scale, then the main contribution to the mixing comes from the U-carb. And this contribution is quite small. So it is there, but it is subdominant contribution. But this is an important assumption. We don't analyze here the spectra where at the mediation scale have strong left-right mix. One may ask what happens if this lepton decays immediately into lepton and gravitino, namely prone two-body decay, which bypasses sneutrinos, the intermediate state. Actually, even though it's two-body decay, it's controlled by dimension 5 term in the Lagrangian suppressed by the Suzy breaking scale. So the suppression in this vertex is quite strong. It's the Suzy breaking scale. One can actually ask when this decay becomes comparable, and the answer is that it becomes comparable when Suzy breaking scale is around 2 to 3 TeV. So Suzy breaking scale of 2 to 3 TeV is something which is very, very difficult to get. No weakly coupled models are known. One can maybe think about non-strongly coupled models with 2 to 3 TeV Suzy breaking scale. No explicit examples are known yet. So all the examples of the models which people give have much, much higher scale of the Suzy breaking. So usually those decay are unimportant.
So these decays become important because the gravitino is so light then? Or?
No, first of all, because of the gravitino is so light, but mainly because this is dimension 5 derivative operator in the Lagrangian suppressed by the mass of the Suzy breaking scale. The suppression scale becomes very small. You should think about this operator as one divided, as vertex as one divided by some high scale mass. And if the Suzy breaking scale is high, which people usually assume, for example, several dozens TeV, hundreds TeV, or even maybe 10 to the 10 GeV, then this vertex is proportional 1 to the 10 to 10 G, 1 over 10 to 10 GeV. It's a huge suppression. So the decay rate becomes very, 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 very small. Nonetheless, if the suppression is just above the superpartner scale, then it may become important.
That's probably something like 1 over square root m gravitino times m black as well.
No, it's 1 over square root. Well, f is Suzy breaking scale squared. It's misleading to call it gravitino. You don't decay into gravitino. You actually decay into Goldstino, because Goldstino is the lightest, mass zero particle, which is then eaten by gravitino when supersymmetry is broken, and the couplings to the Goldstino are proportional to 1 over the Suzy breaking scale rather than 1 to the M plus scale. So the decays are related to Goldstino, into this component which is eaten. Going back here, so we also assume that there is no strong flavor non-degeneracy. What do I mean, strong flavor non-degeneracy? That, for example, the mass of Stahl is smaller than the mass of this neutrino, of the muon neutrino, and then new decay chains become open. This situation is quite hard to get, because most of the mediation scenarios which are not excluded are quite flavor degenerate, And the only contribution to the knowledge generacy comes from the running, and these contributions are not very small. And since we remember that the splitting between the star, left-handed star and the leptons is about 20 GeV, between the neutrino and the leptons around 20 GeV, if we demand star becoming lighter than this neutrino, we are talking about more than 20 GeV non-degeneracy. It's not so easy to get. This can happen from time to time in high-scale mediation, where the soft with non-universal Higgs boundary conditions, namely when the soft mass of the downtype Higgs is much, much bigger than the soft mass of the uptype Higgs, we will not treat this possibility further. We actually talk about this possibility in our second work, but here probably I will not talk about this possibility. So which events are we going to be interested in? Which production mechanism are we going to be interested in? It turns out that in this situation, direct electron production is extremely hard for two different reasons. It's either very hard to trigger on this, just because most of the leptons which are promised are usually soft because of the physical reason, and actually very hard to reduce the backgrounds, usually both. We will see that once we assume strong production, we then cascade decays in the electron particles. This actually may be okay, and we can see some interesting signatures. So we'll further concentrate on the Kautz superpartners production in Palermo. And we will concentrate in general on leptonic channel, and we will see if those are different from the neutrino LSP. In principle, this approach to take a look on the leptonic channel and try to understand what's going on there is actually quite natural. We know that our LSP, or actually an LSP, is completely unchanged. The only handle which we have is that this particle carries flavor number. So something in the decay chain, if everything decays into the invisible particle which carries the flavor number, somewhere we should see compensation for this flavor number in the decay chain. It's kind of generic. It can be either lepton or neutrino. So even without going in the details and assuming that around half of the events compensate by leptons for this flavor number, we should take a look and concentrate on the leptonic channels. So here I actually go to the classification of the spectrum and how we distinguish what we call active spectra in the quotation marks from the inactive spectra and the main differences between them. So usually the mixing in the Gugino-Hixino sector is not so big. It is there, it is proportional to the wave of Higgs and the coupling of SU2 and U1, but it's usually a subdominant contribution. Given that this is a subdominant contribution, there is one neutralino in the spectrum which we can refer as Beano-like, namely the main constituent of this neutralino as Beano. So let's first think about the possibility where the right-handed leptons here say E sub R, I mean all right-handed leptons, all three generations, are heavier than Beano-like neutralino. In this case, assuming strong production, we almost don't produce right-handed leptons, just because WNOS will decay up to tiny mixings into the left-handed leptons rather than right-handed leptons. We call this spectra inactive, referring to the inactivity of this particle. This state is almost never excited in the decay chain, and at the level of the electroweak particles, we analyze the system, which effectively has WNO, BNO, and left-handed doublet. No participation of the right-handed leptons in the spectrum. It turns out that it's much easier first to learn this spectra and then turn to the different spectra where right-handed leptons is actually activated. If this ordering reverses, the spectrum becomes what we call active, because this particle is active. And it turns out, I will not talk too much about this, but at least in one sentence, that phenomenology of this spectra are very similar to the leptogenic supersymmetry which was analyzed by Gigi Fang, De Simone, Schmaltz,
Sam. And Sam.
Yeah,
Sam.
What's Sam?
And Sam.
And Sam,
the other author.
We know
her.
Sorry. it's quite similar to this phenomenology with one main difference. They had charged massive particle at the bottom of the spectrum, and they took advantage of this particle in order to reconstruct the full events. We will not have this particle at the bottom of the spectrum as we're talking about the active spectra. Nonetheless, those are going to be quite leptogenic spectra with quite with significant ability to produce two or even three leptons just from one side of the decay chain, which means that even four leptons or five leptons are going to be quite ubiquitous in this scenario. I will talk maybe a little bit about this scenario at the end. So, let's first concentrate on the inactive spectra and just count the leptons. How much leptons do we expect to get? What do we expect to get in the leptonic channels? And let's make first very simple assumptions. We'll see them from the simulations that some of these assumptions are not so bad, so they give us correct order of magnitude of the estimation. So very simplistic assumptions that the production is only QCD, that there are no decays into Higgs zenos of the heavy colored particles. Phase space effects are negligible. Usually those are order one effects. This is why what I'm talking about is really order of magnitude. And that taus are never leptons. They are indeed not leptons in 65% of the cases. So let's assume, let's not count taus in this analysis. If we assume that there are no decays into Higgs zenos, we produce only colored particles and they decay into electronic particles. They can either decay into, they can actually decay only into G genus, namely either short genus or neutrinos. Short genome can either decay into the lepton and neutrino, or into neutrino and slepton. Let's first forget about all this part. We're told that this mass splitting is small, this lepton is probably soft. Let's, at the first step, not count it. We will count it further. It will give very interesting signature, but at the first step, let's ignore this. So, neutrino, so Chargino has roughly 50% chance with these very simplistic assumptions to produce either lepton or tau. Turns out that the same happens with the neutrino. Neutrino can either go to neutrinos neutrino or leptons lepton. Again, let's forget about the second part about this three-body decay. Again, 33% to produce lepton, 50% to produce just missing energy, the rest are taus. So let's just summarize this counting. In each SUSY event, with these assumptions, we expect to get two G genus at the intermediate state. There are no other possibilities. Each G genus has 1/3 chance to emit a hard lepton. I mean, I don't count now soft leptons, leptons which come from three-body decays. Each of them have 1/3 chance. Then we can just count the events, take into account the fact that in order to get a dileptonic event, we must have two different leptons from different chains. Just because with these assumptions and without counting three-body decays, no decay chain can produce more than one lepton. It must be one. So with this counting, we find that monoleptonic to dileptonic lepton ratio is 4:1. Or we never have two leptons from the same side of the chain. And since they come both from different chains, they are completely uncorrelated, both in sign and in flavor. Namely, we expect, let me say what are these abbreviations I'm going to use further, that the number of dileptonic opposite sign, opposite flavor events, those events, is going to be roughly equal to the number of opposite sign, same flavor, and the beams with the same signs. Namely, we're going to have lots of events with the same sign flavors. Same sign dileptons. Those are considered to be usually very spectacular events because the backgrounds in the standard model are quite small. But what is more important, because of this complete loss of correlation, we expect all these channels to be roughly equal. Now, we should remember that, of course, we neglected three-body decays, and we should now take them into account. So W star decays, and how does this counting change? First of all, only part of this leptons is visible, so it will. This point will definitely affect the.
Because of the softness.
Sorry?
Because of the softness.
Because of the softness, yes. Further in simulations, we assume that we reconstruct only the leptons which are harder than 5 GeV. Probably it's even better. You can do even better with the muons, but we have a handful of events which are even softer than 5 GeV. So only part of them are going to be visible. Exact counting depends now precisely on Chergino neutralino fraction, which in turn depends on if you produce more winos or more pinos. So this is very production dependent. But what is more important is that we can have now two leptons from the same chain. This happens if neutralino decays. Neutralino can decay into lepton and septon, and this lepton precisely decays through this three-body decay. And this is the possibility to get two leptons from the same side of the chain. But talk further that the flavor correlation between this lepton and the parent is lost just because it's double. But the flavor of the parent is actually the flavor of the first lepton, of the harder lepton. So we can get pairs of the leptons from the same side of the chain. They must be opposite sign, namely they are sign correlated, but they are completely flavor uncorrelated just because the decay is mediated by double. Let's just summarize what we know. So monoleptonic to dileptonic channel, we expect it to be of order of magnitude of 4 to 1. And if soft leptons are taken into account, actually it turns out that it's looks more like 3 to 1. What is important here is just remember the order of magnitude, because once I'm going to talk about the spectra which can fade this possibility, they usually tend to produce this ratio in a completely different order of magnitude, something like 10 to 1. The structure of the dileptonic channel now changes, since we have the excess of opposite sign flavor uncorrelated events. We expect roughly the same number of opposite sign, opposite flavor, and opposite sign, same flavor leptons, but expect them to be bigger than same sign, opposite flavor, and same sign, same flavor channels. Opposite sign excess can actually account from 15% to 50% of all dileptonic events, and this number is depends very strongly on the production. And unlike in lots of other supersymmetric patterns, we do not expect any OSSM access. OSSM access, we just don't get here. That's just not origin of the OSSM access. So how should we treat dileptonic channel? And in order to talk how should we treat dileptonic channel, I would like to take one step backwards to the regular supersymmetry with neutralino LSP, with neutralino LSP, and compare it to the treatment of the OSSF access which we have in this scenario.
Before you get into the same topic, can you come back to the summary slide again? I'm losing the thread of it, because will you be showing us any plots or anything?
Sorry?
Will you be showing us any plots?
Yes, once I go to... would you like me to show them now? Because yes, definitely I'm going to show full simulations and to show how is it reflected in full simulations.
Okay, so let me just while you have it up. I guess the thing I don't quite have a handle on from so far, which I think you said, it's just that I think I caught it, was I'm not really sure to what extent there were a bunch of assumptions that got made, and I'm not sure how good they are. So should I be expecting that this is good at the 10% level, or is this good to the 1/3 level, or?
In principle, I think that in this case, I'm talking about the access. It's actually already the result of the simulation, so it's not. So there are not so much assumptions here. But the rest, the ones that we're talking 4:1, 3:1, I think it can be taken up to even the factor of 2.
So 4:1 versus 3.
Because I have lots of very simplistic assumptions. And this, what's interesting with the simplistic assumptions, they already give you correct picture of, correct qualitative picture, but definitely not correct quantitative. Because I never counted taus, and taus are produced with the same rate, and 35% of them are leptons. So this will affect. Now, and there are also lots of more factors which I just cannot catch here. I just need simulations. For example, how I don't know a priori how many leptons I'm going to lose, for example, soft leptons because of their softness, or how many of them I'm going to use because of the isolation cuts, because softer your lepton, easier to lose it just because of the isolation cuts you impose. Andy?
Okay, so I'm happy with that. So it's qualitative, and you're going to show us plots later on. So one other thing I'd like to know is the class of models for which this is applying.
It definitely applies for all the models of gauge mediation, also with this neutrino.
Well, we're not listing the model, but the thing that you've assumed, the important thing you've assumed is that the lightest guys were the Sleptons.
Yes. No, the lightest guy, I assume that the lightest guy is neutrino.
Okay.
This is what I assume.
Not the whole doublet. At one point I thought you said the whole.
No, the whole doublet. This is important. But since the splitting inside this doublet is around 20 GeV or smaller, you could actually expect that if there's no accidental compressing of the whole spectrum, it will be actually a case.
And is that all, or because your graphs are drawing, it looks like you have a neutrino going into those things. Is there an assumption somehow that there is? Is there an implicit assumption there as to who will dominantly produce these guys, or is that?
No, there's no. Here actually there is an assumption that, let's go assumptions one by one. There is an assumption, of course, that QCD production, it's not an assumption. I will impose such cuts that I will capture only QCD production.
And that means
the
ultimately it's coming from gluons?
Either gluons or squarks. Now, no decays into Higgsinos. Usually, the fraction of this decays is going to be quite minor, because the decays into Higgsinos are proportional to the gauge couplings. Decays into Higgsinos are proportional proportional to the Yukawa couplings. So unless you produce stops, which are produced, of course, but not dominantly, it is quite suppressed. It just because the decay is proportional to the Yukawa coupling, and the rate is proportional to the Yukawa coupling squared. So it becomes this contribution becomes really minor, and this assumption is actually a very good assumption. This assumption is important.
It's a very good assumption. If I take the class of all these the squirts and gluons and then look at what they all decay to, or is it a good assumption given the final stage you're going to look at?
Sir, can you repeat the question?
Is your statement that so the first line was you're saying I'm assuming I somehow get sparks that gluons and they decay and I'm watching them decay.
Yes.
Now the second line is that for all of those decays it's never going into Higgsinos first part.
Yes, actually in practice stops and from time to time some portion of bottoms will go to Higgsinos. But since if it's, for example, squark-dominated production is usually flavor-blind, it's going to be a minor portion of the events.
Okay. And in the tiles are near lepton line, then what was the significance of that?
It's significant that I still didn't count the tiles, but 35% of tau decays are actually decays into leptons. And since the event is not fully reconstructable, You cannot distinguish between them. It's just left. I didn't count this here. But for example, once I have all these decay chains, in principle, you have, of course, the same decay chain where instead of lepton, you will have tau. And 35% of these taus will eventually be either electrons or muons. And I will, in practice, in full simulation, I will have to count them either as electrons or as muons. I just don't have any other trace.
So in the quality, it's not producing
very much. In the quality, but it's 35% of the production. So you understand it's even less than order one correction.
So can you also, I think to remember that there was a paper by Laura Kogi and Sabine Crummel. They also studied this neutrino.
And they tried to, yes.
So can you point out what is the difference?
The difference? They never analyze, they just draw Feynman diagrams and simulate it incorrectly the spectrum. This is the difference. And they didn't analyze the channels, they didn't analyze the signals, they didn't say where it's possible, where it's not. They just draw the Feynman diagrams, and the Feynman diagrams, my Feynman diagrams, and their Feynman diagrams are, of course, identical. They didn't do anything beyond this.
So they didn't study, huh?
No, they didn't study, for example, this study of the channels is not there. So they didn't say what channels should you look for in Collider. They didn't say how is it different from other spectra. So in principle, they didn't do this study.
So you're saying they didn't do a discovery study at all?
They didn't do Collider study at all. They had the model. And they underlined what is the model. The study, first of all, was very model-dependent. They underlined the model with non-universal Higgs mass boundary condition. That title is very misleading because they have LHC in the title, but it's really not the paper about LHC. Among all the models I was talking about, they emphasized one model. They simulated several spectra. They said what can be the particle ordering, and they dropped Feynman diagrams. So it was a different search. It was a different study.
But what did they actually calculate with the Feynman diagrams?
Nothing. At least if you open the paper, nothing. Look, I'm not the author of this paper.
No, I don't know. I'm not
We noticed this paper from the very beginning because it has both neutrino and LHC in the title. They didn't do this job. So how do we usually treat dielectronic channel? In regular neutrino LSP. We'll study from this quite a lot about what we should do in our case, how we should modify our searches in our case. So where does this excess come from? It actually comes from the second neutrino decaying into the first neutrino mediated by slapton. Since it's mediated by slapton and we assume no flavor violation because of the existing constraints, two of the slaptons are going to be of the same flavor and opposite sides. So this is always a self-excess response which we usually have in neutrino LSP. It's this excess of OSSF sits actually on top of supersymmetric combinatorial background, because one can get OSSF pairs coming from different sides of the events. If they come from different sides of the events, they are, of course, not correlated. But event by event, we cannot distinguish between this OSSF pair and the OSSF pairs which came one from different channels. This can be purified, not event by event, by statistical mechanism, which is called subtraction. We subtract all OSOF events from OSSF events. What's the logic of this? This is the characteristic shape we usually get in OSSF, because these correlated OSSF pairs, which come from the same side of the chain, have very characteristic, if this selectron was on shell, the shape is, in terms of diatonic invariant mass, has very characteristic RM and H shape. But it, of course, sits on top of the signal, on top of the signal which comes from OSSF pairs coming from different decay chains. Since being opposite sign and same flavor is completely accidental for these cases of different decay chains, we expect up to statistical fluctuation that opposite sign, opposite flavor signal has precisely the same shape, because those are indeed uncorrelated flavors. So we can subtract, and this is what, and after, and at the end of the day, it works very well up to statistical fluctuation. OSOF signal, assuming that OSSF pairs coming from different decay chains have actually the same shape from OSSF. Usually, once people, this is just a cartoon picture, of course, usually when people perform this subtraction, they get this very clean rampant edge structure after the subtraction. Let's now compare to our case. We also have a signal in the diatonic channel. Those are correlated pairs of leptons coming from neutralino decays, but our signal is placed both in opposite sign, opposite flavor, and opposite sign, same flavor bits. And it sits on the background, which is equally distributed between all these four bins, because there's no sign preference for the decay if the decay comes from two different decay chains. So what we can, or the procedure which we can use here, is actually take all opposite sign without counting the flavors, take all opposite sign leptons and subtract from them same sign dileptons. By this procedure, we will be able to see what is the shape of the distribution and what actually the shape which we expect. We have two body decay of Gugino going to lepton and slepton. Then slepton further decays into three body decay. What should we expect from the dileptal invariant mass in this case? Without spins, it was just first considered by Thomas Tucker Smith and Weiner, and it was shown that this distribution is quite bumpy. With spins, turns out that very few changes. This is the distribution. Black line is precisely what Thomas Tucker Smith and Weiner got, namely without spins, just integrating over the phase space. Red line is an analytical calculation in the limit where Scitrino is non-relativistic. We can make, and it's actually a very fair approximation here, which looks that actually this distribution is not very different from Webb. These nodes are results of the actual simulation of one of these spectra done by the program which is called Bridge. You see that it actually quite nicely agrees with the prediction given by the red line. The edge point of the distribution is actually precisely the same edge point where we have two body decays going to two body decays. But instead of getting ramp and edge, this is actually a very, it decays quite smoothly into this end point. And the peak of this distribution is placed roughly at MLL edge point over 2. So it's roughly the half of the endpoint. And this actually also was a very similar result was actually also given by Thomas Tucker Smith and Weiner, where they took this integrating of the parameter space without matrix elements, and they got that the peak of this distribution is placed on the HF divided by square root of 5, which is some multiplication by 0.042. What can we expect from the trailton? Once we take into account the soft leptons, we also see that we have trailtonic events. Those are very important because they are very clean. There are very few standard model backgrounds to these events. And they can actually give us additional evidence. They can show actually precise, more or less the same distribution. We can get the strand leptons getting two leptons from one side of the chain, opposite side and random flavor, flavor uncorrelated, and one lepton from another side of the chain. So we would like to take a look on dileptone invariant mass of these two leptons which come from the same side of the chain. But there is, again, combinatorial ambiguity. We don't know which two leptons out of three we should pair. So here's the procedure we use. And turns out that it actually works very, very good. Since the second lepton in the same decay chain comes from three-body decay, usually it's the softest lepton in the event. So we can take the softest lepton among three of the opposite sign leptons, among three, and pair it with the opposite sign lepton among two hard leptons. If there is an ambiguity, we can put this event aside. It's going to be good for discovering of new physics, but not for this particular analysis. But since there is no special law why these two hard leptons are supposed to be of the same sign, in roughly half of the events, they are of the opposite signs. So this procedure will go. We will know who should repair the softest lepton. And then we can plot dileptron invariant mass, and it will actually reproduce, we expect it to reproduce more or less the same bump we had in, just a minute, here, in the dileptonic events, because we pair the dileptons out of these three, which have the same physics, which come from the same physical origin. Additional handle to discriminate from the SUSY fakers, probably I will not have too much time to talk about the fakers, is actually jet lepton invariant mass. Sometimes it works, not always. Why will it work? Once we have, for example, squark production, squark which decays through gigino into quark and lepton, and this gigino is usually on shell, usually has very characteristic shape, again, of rampant edge. May carry important information, the numerical value of this edge can carry important information about the masses of squarks and gigenos, and it may be important discriminating from the fakers. So, ideally, it could be a good tool, not always, because sometimes it is actually gluon-dominated production. Even in the squark case, we have built-in combinatorial ambiguity, which we cannot get rid of, because we have two different chains. Both squark produce two different jets. We don't know who should repair. With gluon, the situation is much worse. We have two different jets, usually. And if this guy is off-shell, if gluons are lighter than squarks, then we even get the situation which is worse, because this squark and this lepton, or even this quark and this lepton, will not have any well-defined shape. So this tool of jet lepton invariant mass might or might not work. So let me skip this slide because I'm running out of time, and actually go directly into the simulations. So let's take one of the spectra and see how we would work on practice after we simulate full events, decay, and see what's going on. Just don't pay attention that the Higgs is 112 GeV. Higgs is completely unimportant for the signatures, those electronic signatures, so it's indeed unimportant. Squarks here are around 900 to 950 GeV. All the Higgs sector, namely Higgs xenons, axial Higgs, is around 500 GeV. Right-handed leptons are heavier than mostly Beno, so it's indeed inactive spectrum I was talking about. Winos around 333 light-handed leptons, and neutrinos are around 200 GeV.
Yes. So you said that the Higgs here is completely unimportant, but on the other hand, I mean, sometimes it might be difficult to push the Higgs mass over the lab bound?
Not here. Actually, I show here two different spectra. The second spectrum is where gluonos are here and quarks are here, and there actually you already fixed it. It's very easy to push here the Higgs. We just didn't want to change too much. It's actually it's really hard in this case. And the stop here is heavy enough. It's more than 900 GeV, so it's definitely enough to push Higgs well. So this is precisely what we had under control, that our colored particles are heavy enough that in principle Higgs is, even if Higgs is below the lab bounds, the spectra where Higgs is actually pushable to the lab bound, given also the difference is 2 GeV with the bond. So before we go to the signals, let's discuss backgrounds. Those are indeed important. And it turns out that there are three backgrounds. One can think about quantum backgrounds. There are three which are really important. Those three. TT bar has a huge cross section of 600 picobar, even at the tree level. It can be background to monoleptonic channel, dieleptonic channel, and even trialeptonic. WW plus jets is a bit smaller, but still very important. Turns out that after the cut spacing we imposed, it's WW is as important as TTBAR. Very important, surprisingly very important background is tau plus jets, usually tau produced through either Z star or gamma star. Not very big background, it's dangerous for the dieleptonic channel, but also quite hard to get rid of in background. So after the cuts, it becomes of the same order of magnitude. All these backgrounds are less important. W plus jets for monoelectronic channel is easily removable. W star with further decaying leptonically is also important because Z decaying into tau is already included here. This background turns out to be quite small, with jets, of course. One may worry for monoelectronic channel about BB bar and CC bar. It's really up to experiment with how to treat these backgrounds because they don't have true leptons and you just do better improving your isolation cuts. So we can just rely on the experimenters that they say they are under control.
You just remind me, you probably said it, but what is your cross-section for this one here?
Around 1 picobar.
Yeah, picobar, okay.
Bit less, around 1 picobar, actually. So, yeah, it looks a bit scary once you have the first background around 600.
So your scenario is always confined to low dungeon speed, is that right? Because you have to control the left-right mixing.
No. Even the left-right mixing, if it's proportional to the color coupling, still becomes under control with tangent beta equals step. Actually, most of our cases is tangent beta equals step. It still works. Because it's proportional to the color couplings. And your color couplings are small even for time, it's 10 to the minus 2 essentially. So you have tangent beta enhancement, it becomes 10 to the minus 1. Still small. It's like it's still subdominant contribution to the D term speed. So what cuts we impose in order to get rid of these backgrounds? What do we lose actually? Concentrating QCD production will first demand that transverse momentum of first leading jets is both harder than 300 GeV. Usually people don't impose such hard cuts. They allow the leading jets to be a bit softer in SUSY searches. This is also usually driven by this mechanism of subtraction, OSSF minus OSOF, which is relevant for neutralino LSP. This subtraction also reduces TT-bar background because dileptons in TT-bar are genuinely flavor uncorrelated and opposite sign. So, but since we are not going to perform this subtraction, the subtraction is actually completely meaningless in our case. We just have to tighten the cuts. We demand a missing transverse energy more than 200 GeV. We have missing heavy particle, so probably we don't miss too much of the events because of this. This background effectively reduces This cut effectively reduces the background, which comes from W plus jets. We reduce the we demand transverse mass of the W of the lepton and missing energy in monoleptonic events to be more than 100 GeV, mass squared more than 100 GeV squared. If we have W plus jets, since W and jet full invariant, lepton missing energy full invariant mass should reconstruct W, transverse invariant mass should be smaller than the mass of the W, given that the resolution is not perfect, we demand 100 GeV. This actually very effectively removes W plus jets, very effectively removes monoleptonic TT bar, because monoleptonic TT bar is W plus jets. So, what leptons do we rely on? Something technical, so let me go quite fast. We demand quite hard isolation cuts, usually harder than most of the experimental researchers demand, that less than 10% of the hadronic activity in delta R equals 0.4. We define in this search two different creatures. One of them is tight lepton, the second is loose lepton. What's the difference between them, and where can do we allow ourselves to use loose leptons? If our lepton fulfills this condition, it's a tight lepton. If it doesn't, we take a look on this hadronic activity and ask, if in this cone of delta R equals 0.4, this hadronic activity exceeds 10 GeV or doesn't exceed 10 GeV. If it doesn't exceed 10 GeV, we don't count it as heavy flavor. We count it as a loose lepton. In principle, it might be quite dangerous because this behavior can be faked by heavy flavors. Nonetheless, it turns out that if we have in the event more than two leptons, the backgrounds from heavy flavors is usually very small here. So in monoleptonic and dileptonic channel, we never take into account those leptons. Where you have multileptonic events, three lepton, four lepton, we allow the third lepton to be loose. And of course, we reconstruct leptons with PT more than 5 GeV, safe for muons, and probably okay for well-isolated electrons.
Sorry, you probably already said this, I must have just missed it. How exactly are you simulating this? Are you using PT, or what are you doing?
Definitely not, because PT never keeps angular correlation. Thank you for the question, I never told this.
Yes.
We simulated with a Matograph, just events without decaying. Because decays with Matograph or full supersymmetry will take any time, then decays with bridge. For hadronization, we use Pythia after we have a full event. Pythia with tau over, so we do not decay taus in bridge, because tau bridge will take taus and decay them partonically, which gives you incorrect decay branching ratios. But if you go to bridge to Pythia with tau over knows precisely the cross section for. Tau knows precisely the decay rates for tau, so we hadronize it with Pythia, shower and hadronize, and then we reconstruct the event and cluster them into GS with fast jet.
Okay, so it's Matograph to bridge.
Matograph bridge, Pythia.
And then bridge to Pythia.
Pythia perpendicular with tau fast jet. Because clustering with Pythia is also quite dangerous. Some of the clustering mechanisms are not IR safe.
So this always just scares me when all these tools are being used. Is it possible for there to be another simulation path? Like, is any other package out there?
It's possible.
Allow you to do the same analysis, or is there any other package out there, like Scherfer or something else, some other Monte Carlo?
Mm-hmm.
That would allow you to do this, so you can compare with
you. First of all, you can do everything with Matograph. You can do everything with Matograph, just takes too much time. Bridge is good because it's much faster. This is why we went into Bridge. In principle, it's durable. We made simulations with I think, 7 or 8 spectra. I just showed one or two of them, but in principle we did much more. With one of them we made what we call sanity check. We checked this with a Mad graphic and gives us the same results.
Okay.
It just takes, it takes several days to wait for full simulation of Mad graph.
Yeah, but you did some sanity check.
Yes, definitely yes. You can always do it by Herrick, I just don't know how to use it.
Okay.
Probably Herrick is not expected to be either worse or better than this problems. And this is what experimentalists usually use, Herrick. So here's the counting of the leptons with the backgrounds. And gray beans are the beans of the signal. How much time do I have? I'll try to converge fast. So what we see is, first of all, monoelectronic to dielectronic ratio is around 1 to 3, so it's correct order of magnitude. We have also a handful of trielectronic and even polyelectronic events, which is also quite expected. Everything is, of course, simulated for 100 in respect to our integrated luminosity. Here's the structure of the dielectronic channel, and first of all, about a little bit about the backgrounds. Precisely as I told, there are 3 important backgrounds, which we didn't get used or get rid of even with the scats. TT bar, WW plus yes, tau tau. Tau tau is also important, this red string. Well, this is what we see actually, that OSOF and OSSF are bigger significantly than same sign beams. This same sign is actually excellent for early discovery because the backgrounds from the standard model are tiny and they come only from WW plus jets, and those are tiny. This OSSF, OSOF beam is bit bigger, not because of any physical reason, but just because all OSSF pairs with invariant mass in the window between 80 and 100 GeV will reconstruct as Z and put aside. But of course, there are some true pairs which we misidentify as Z and also put aside. This is what bit depletes OSSF statistics.
Sorry, just another question. What center mass energy are you doing here?
Sorry?
What center mass energy?
14.
14?
Yes.
That's right. But and how much data would you say an early discovery is for?
If you ask for early discovery,
yeah.
And then for early discovery, both of these are unimportant. They have two high backgrounds. Mm-hmm. Those are important probably for early discovery, and with less than 10 inverse femto bar, you will have already, you will see that there's a new physics. Just like divide the number of events by 10. From 400, you go to 40 events with background essentially 2 to 3 events. Mm-hmm. All coming from WW plus jets. Dielectronic mass in dielectronic invariant mass, and here I also compare to the backgrounds. Opposite signs have this peak. I will go further and talk a little bit more about this peak using the subtraction mechanism, the procedure which we propose. Same sign precisely have more or less random distribution. Backgrounds mostly have random distribution. The only background with non-random distribution and precisely in the dangerous region and also for physical reason is tau tau. So tau tau should be taken into account. Now we perform the sign subtraction I was talking about. We clearly see the bump here. What would we expect to see? In principle, if we take open the box, take the spectrum and calculate where would we where would we expect to see the bumps? We would expect to see two bumps corresponding to two different neutrinos at 31 and 40 GeV. They're sitting one on top of each other. This is why they are smeared into one bump. 31 and 40 is not too well separated. But we see that this bump definitely agrees. All the errors are just statistical errors. They are sitting one precisely where we would expect them to sit. Trielectronic channel is even more cleaner and suggestive because with these cuts, we have literally no backgrounds. With these cuts, remove all the backgrounds, so up to statistical fluctuation, so we can expect 2 to 3 events after 100 inverse femtobarn of backgrounds leaking due to detector smearing, not more than this. And using the procedure of pairing I was talking about, we have this very nice bump, precisely at 31, around 31 GeV, where we would expect it to have. So it confirms the picture which we have in science subtraction, and on top of that, that it confirms it, it gives us a very reliable picture, because we know that here we had backgrounds on which we have only partial control, TT bar, tau, tau. Here there is no background, it's all signal, and we clearly see it, and we clearly see it. Jet lepton invariant mass corresponding to the cascade of scorpion to neutralino and to lepton. Would expect to see ramp and edge. It's not too rampy here, just because of the combinatorial ambiguity, but the drop is clearly seen precisely where we would expect it to see. We expect it to see around 625 GeV according to our calculation. So, since I'm heavily running out of time, I will not show you other simulations, and I will not talk about the active spectra. I will go to the conclusions. Neutrino and LSP is an interesting possibility, and it is a well-motivated question how one can possibly distinguish it from neutrino. We show that very big class of models have very distinct collider signatures. The signatures of the inactive spectra is not easy to fake. This is the part that you didn't have enough time to show, but it is not easy to fake. And if discovered, should be considered as a clear evidence for neutrino and LSP. And with careful analysis, one can probably use slightly modified tools to, in order to analyze the active spectra. This is what I also didn't have time to show you, covering the whole range of spectra of with neutrino and LSP. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
So how does it scale? I just couldn't do the mental scaling. For a 7 TeV run, it's sort of luminosity we expect.
For 7 TeV run, I don't have an answer. I have an answer for 10 TeV run, because this is what we thought is going to run. So I know that the cross sections fall in principle by a factor of 3 for 10 TeV.
Mm-hmm.
It will fall definitely more for 7 TeV, I just don't know how. Probably a factor of 4, factor of 5. So, same sign that leptons can give some evidence, probably with 10 TeV run, but probably not with, even for 7 TeV run, but probably not for luminosity one inverse femtobarn.
Yeah. So you would expect
at least those are going to be single digit. It's going to be single digit number of events.
Yeah.
Probably not so big. You will never be sure if these events are some flukes of the detector or maybe background, which you didn't take into account, because you never build your statistics starting from two events. So
you said basically the answer that if we get the run we expect, if this scenario is realized,
in this sense, it's actually not different from most of the superstition models, which do not expect anything interesting for run with 70 TeV,
okay.
Unless it's some. It's some supersymmetry which has colored particles right beyond the corner. And in order to have this and to be the constraints on Higgs, you usually need to have very big left-right splittings, namely very big A terms. Oh, possible. But we didn't study this possibility is from the theoretical point of view, so it's a bit unlikely given also the scenarios we thought about. Possible, but again, if it's not the case and you indeed beat the constraints on Higgs and your colored particles are indeed about 900 GeV, I don't think that it's different from any other supersymmetric spectrum people were analyzing and were quite pessimistic about such a 7 TeV at low luminosity.
Okay. Any other questions? Let's thank Andrea again.